Hello, horny-handed toilers of the content fields. Welcome to another edition of Big Mouth. I'm Andrew Harrison, and here with me is Everett's Sian Pattinen, the connoisseur woman from Del Monte of Pop to my bin-dipping yellow label addict. Hello, Sian, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
Delighted to hear that. Pleasant week.
Pleasant is an unusual word. Worried about the unseasonably warm weather, but let's get on.
Yeah, it is. Planet scorched to death. It's been a big week for pop nomenclature because somebody has finally trumped Brian Eno in the lengthy name stakes. It's Robert Trujillo of Metallica. Would you like to take a crack at his full name as revealed by Lars Ulrich on Instagram?
Of course I would. I'm not going to make a fool of myself, am I?
Right.
Roberto Gas de Miguel Santiago Samuel Perez de la Santa Concepción Trujillo Vera Cruz Bautista.
That's pretty good, actually.
It's not bad,
stumble
is it?
Over it. It actually beats Brian Peter George St. John Le Baptiste de la Salle Eno and Florian Claude de Bunuvel O'Malley Armstrong, a.k.a. Dido, by several words, I think.
By several words, it does. And apparently Hispanic names are traditionally long, so there's probably a few pop stars in hiding that have even longer names.
Probably podcasting this alone, isn't it? We have two guests with us this week. Sian, would you like to introduce our first one?
I certainly would. She writes about TV, pop, podcasts and more for The Guardian. She's a graduate of Smash It, the reform school for pop delinquents, and her Twitter bio says, "I'm your freelance writer, a writer for money." It's Hannah Verdier. Hooray! Wise words from Tina Turner there. Will any old pop star do?
Anything will do, really, at the moment. Anything you like.
Not that we want people to listen to other podcasts, obviously, but you've recently been bigging up the Ron Burgundy podcast. What's going on there?
Yes, at first I had mixed feelings about Will Ferrell back to his Anchorman best with Ron Burgundy. It's so cringeworthy, but it works. It just works. I thought he might go too far on it, but I think he's resurrected the character very well.
Right. And what is his subject matter? Is it broad?
I think he was talking to a crime expert about whether you could kill an ex and get away with it. That sort of thing. So it's very broad.
It's very broad and obviously informative.
Very, very.
Also with us, she's an author, illustrator and one-time music journalist, now fully recovered, and a Pet Shop Boys nut. And among her pop-inspired kids' books is The Cow Who Fell to Earth, in which a bovine from beyond the stars lands on Earth and everyone says, "Hello, space cow." It's Nadia Shireen. Hello, Nadia. How are you doing?
Hi, very well.
Welcome back. A lot of your books sound like they're playing for the going to be playing at the Hebden Bridge Trades Club tonight. Yeti and the Bird, Bumble Bear and Good Little Wolf. They're all good for the second stage at Latitude, surely.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're
heavily bearded dudes singing about their breakups.
You're right. Yeti and the Bird especially.
Yeah, hi, I'm Bumble Bear. And yeah. I've got a new record out.
Good evening,
Matador. Yeah. Acoustic set. You two are a Smash Hits veteran. What were your duties there?
My duties were, I was a sub-editor and briefly a production editor before they saw sense. And so that meant basically spellings and picture captions, which was great because the annotations and the picture captions were always my favourite bit of Smash Hits.
Yes.
Anyway, so it was actually a dream to be able to do them. The era that I was there, it was mainly doing picture captions about the Cheeky Girls. Ooh. Slightly racist ones where
really?
We pretended that they were vampires from Transylvania. Because they were from Transylvania.
That's factual.
That's factual. So the picture captions were always like, "Hey, I'm going to suck your blood." And we eventually did get a complaint from Mama Cheeky.
So you basically invented Brexit via the media for Smash Hits.
Kind of.
Europhobia. So this is the Cheeky Girls era.
Yeah.
One did fail for Smash Hits at this time because the locus of pop had moved away from the pop charts and into X Factor and Grimm's.
Yeah, and
that.
I think the difficult thing about that, and Hannah was there kind of around a similar time, it was that the pop stars themselves were kind of, they had been media trained within an inch of their lives. So
they were robots, weren't they?
So they just weren't saying anything interesting. It's not that the pop stars didn't exist. You know, you had Busted and Blue and all the rest of it.
Blazing Squad.
And Blazing Squad. That was on my job interview question, was, can you name all the Blazing Squad?
Well,
the correct answer
skill.
Is no, I can't.
Yes.
Nobody should be.
But also it was like, it's the age of Google. I can find this out quite easily. But that was the problem, I think, that we had at Smash Hits, was that the power was with the PRs rather than with us.
What was the high point of your period at Smash Hits?
There were many. I was trapped in a dressing room with Daniel Bedingfield, who started singing to me. That was terrifying.
Oh, no, that's a panic attack.
I said high point.
High point. Oh, my God. Because I'm evil, I loved it when bands would get brought into the office to sing while we were just
horrible.
Busy. And I'd just scowl at them because I was on production. So I had no... I was like, well, I'm not here to be impressed by you, McFly. And would just kind of huffily try and get round to the printers around them whilst they sort of gamely did a little dance and their PR handed out pizzas. Once Girls Aloud came in to turn on the Christmas lights.
And they obviously thought...
In the office. So it'd been sold to them as turn on the Christmas lights.
Yeah.
This literally meant kneel down by the printers and press this plug. Because we bought a little Christmas tree from Argos. You know, the ones that with the lights in.
Yeah, already there.
Yeah, so yeah. That was definitely a high point. Oh, because their face was just... Yeah.
That sounds splendid. I believe there's, Sian, you have a crossover event with Nadia.
I just want to say that the last time I saw Nadia, it was a few weeks after Bowie died in 2016. And we were so upset and we kept sending each other these messages. We'd never met before. We had lots of mutual friends. We were sending each other messages via whatever social medium about how upset we were. We were so upset. We went to a disco in Archway. I don't know if the listeners are... No, the Archway is not the most well-heeled part of London.
Tufnell Park borders.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Barely healed at all, actually.
And watched a load of Archway turbo drinkers swaying to Yasser singing Quicksand. And it was really awful, but actually it made me feel much better. Thank you, Nadia.
Oh, that's good.
We kind of bonded through the trauma, didn't we?
We did.
Of a night out in Archway.
Yeah. Yeah.
The healing has begun. This week on the show, we've got the return of Alan Partridge in This Time on BBC One. Is the original Chatmaster Flash fit for purpose in today's modern and inclusive BBC? Plus your annual injection of Prol Art Threat. Woo. As Sleaford Mods return with fifth album Eaten Alive. That's Eaten as in the school, do you see? Have they updated and expanded their Midlands class rant electro noise? Or does it not need fixing because it isn't broken? And, because we missed it when it came out and it's now on Netflix, totally woke horror movie Get Out. Black guy goes to visit white girlfriend's parents out in the secluded suburbs for the first time. What can possibly go wrong? How does it go wrong and why is the movie so original? Spoiler, it is. All that and more after a gentle reminder from Sian.
Why not start getting Big Mouth a day early? If you sign up to help us with our studio bills on the crowdfunding site Patreon, we'll send you the show a whole 24 hours earlier so you can listen on a Friday should you so desire. You'll also get a special extra bit of additional top quality content where our guests stick around for a bit more conversation and talk about things such as going to Prince's own personal island. That actually happened. This week, in honour of the return of Alan Partridge, we'll be choosing the shows we think need a reboot and who should do them. All we're asking for is the equivalent of the price of a pint each month, a mere £5. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out how you can help. All we are saying is buy us a pint.
Okay, let's start with This Time with Alan Partridge. Every Partridge series has been a slightly different format, from fake chat show to sitcom to fly-on-the-wall documentary. And Steve Coogan's fake investigative documentaries like Alan Partridge's Scissored Isle for Sky have been some of the best work he's done. Now Alan's back on BBC One in a very thinly veiled spoof of The One Show, where he's filling in for the desperately ill regular host. Does it work, and where does Alan fit into Brexit Britain? We're going to talk about it after this.
20 seconds.
Can I have a glass of water, please?
Makeup checks.
So sorry, everyone. Oh, Tony, can you just remember to tweak that?
Hi, anyone. Can I have a glass of water, please?
Yeah, the end bit.
OK, guys, stand by. We're coming on shortly.
Hey, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
You've done plenty of live stuff for us.
Yeah.
You did do that. What was it called? Mid-Morning Matters?
Yes, Mid-Morning Matters.
What was Mid-Morning Matters?
Oh, do you know it?
Yeah, I watched the odd episode. I have to say I loved what I saw.
Well, it's a radio show.
That's right.
Guys, clear the floor.
Can I have some water, please? My mouth is dry.
Stand by. We're going in five.
Can I have some water, please? My mouth is dry.
Dan. In case you're stuck in a hedge, you'll know Alan Partridge is back, although he never entirely went away, and on BBC One. This Time features a mature Alan and his co-host Jenny Gresham, a magazine show very similar to The One Show, as Andrew said, so the absurdity is embedded into the format from the start. Via links such as, coming up, we'll be talking about vegetarianism and gambling. It deals with the power play dynamic between co-presenters, sideways glance at Andrew Harrison, live TV, broken text, soft news and Alan's personality. Hannah, did you know that we wash our hands 30% less than we did 10 years ago?
Well, I do now.
What did you think?
It was quite tricky for me because I do fancy Alan Partridge. And I'm sorry, I can't help it. Not Steve Coogan, but Alan Partridge. Mm-hmm. And I root for him so badly during these shows that I found sort of the first 15 minutes a little bit exhausting, but it was so good to see him back. And I thought it did produce some really great moments, especially when he's on his own. I wasn't too keen on the kind of faux Piers Morgan thing. I thought that was kind of a bit shoehorned in, but when he did the hygiene interview, the subtlety of some things in there when he's talking about Chinaman Square and in the current gender climate, it's like those tiny bits that is what makes him for me. And I love the hacktivist interview as well. It's just so much ego getting in the way.
I felt really sorry for him in the Hacktivist interview. I thought that poor Alan, you can't hack it to Alan's emails, and they weren't that bad, I didn't think.
See, you're rooting for him as well now. This is what he does. I love it.
Well, he's a character that trips up constantly, and maybe that's something to do. You know, he's more sympathetic now than he might have been.
Definitely.
The bit which I'm sure we all wrote down: they toss penguins around like rag dolls and batter them against the sea till they're dead. Just wait for it, for fun. No, we're cringing with it. Nadia, how did you feel about it?
Of course we root for Alan. We are all Alan on some level. I know that I was certainly watching it going, oh, that's what I do. I mean, like Hannah was saying, the hand washing bit I loved, especially when she said, oh, I can go and show you in over there. The sink's just over there if you want. He went, no, we mustn't. mustn't. That I thought was brilliant. I root for Alan. I think it was really hotly anticipated. To a ridiculous degree. So I think, you know, I've seen some sort of online mewling that, oh, it wasn't that good and all the rest of it. I think give it a bit of time. I really enjoyed it. I think I didn't find it surreal at all. I can really easily imagine Alan doing this kind of thing. He's basically Richard Madeley, isn't he? Kind of. So that worked really well, I thought. I think it worked. The only bit that didn't work for me was when we had a break in filming, supposedly, and then we were meant to be watching kind of backstage.
Yes.
That jarred a little bit. It went a bit kind of ghost watch, and I didn't... I was
a bit
scared.
I would love to see ghost watch with Alan Partridge.
Well, I was a bit scared because you just saw the back of Lynn's head.
What did you think of Lynn? Because that was a real surprise of her coming in, seemed to break the fourth wall somewhat.
It was great to see her, but I'm not sure it worked for me that way.
Oh, I love seeing Lynn again. Right. And I love the dynamic, the slight jealousy that she's been with him for so long. I love it.
I like the fact that in this, Lynn has kind of sort of assumed this role of like Alan's Valkyrie, who will not let Alan be ground down. You know, that Alan is kind of clearly has been on the back foot for some time, hasn't he?
Yes.
And I thought the flip on this is because in a lot of ways it actually is a return to Knowing Me, Knowing You. It's kind of the same format, same inanity, same, you know, stupid daytime, early evening TV nonsense. But Alan is now sort of desperately trying to prove himself and edge his way in. And there's Lynn, you know, on the touchline, gritting their teeth and, you know, sort of metaphorically punching the air for him. I thought that was actually kind of rather touching because you've seen the relationship and the power dynamic kind of flip a little bit.
Absolutely. I was surprised how sycophantic she was.
She loves Alan.
Because
she believes in Alan.
Because he's popular. And I thought that gave her the edge to her character. Do you think, Andrew Harrison, that Alan is Brexit Britain? He is, that part of us that actually thinks, yeah, maybe it's a really good idea. I know, obviously, you don't.
Well, this was sort of trailed as it's going to be Alan does Brexit Britain. It turns out not to be. He's not talking about, foreigners and the vampiric cheeky girls
not
or anything
yet.
Like that. you know.
Whoa there now.
Yeah, but it's. I think it taps into a deeper thing about Britain, which is just desperately confused, unhappy men in later life who can't get a handle on things and never really could. I think there's a strange thing happening with that, which when we first met Alan, Coogan was sort of presenting him as a bloke in his mid to late 40s. And in the intervening 25 years, Alan has only aged about 3 years.
Yeah. Well, he's caught up with him, hasn't
It's a little
he,
bit though, like Peter it? Parker in Spider-Man, who's been 16 since 1963, and he's now, maybe he's 25. You know, time is elastic. But Alan, the timelessness of Alanism is still in there. And his sort of, you pointed it out really well, Hannah, like this kind of attempt to sort of connect to the way things are supposed to be done now is both pathetic and cringeworthy, but also kind of admirable.
Understandable.
At least in his Alan-y way, he's trying.
He's trying so hard, isn't he, to be woke, and he's trying so hard to be understood. That there's a bit where they throw over to a correspondent, and the correspondent just really dislikes Alan, so he's just going, no, that's not actually right, Alan. But to everything he says.
And the correspondent is a young black woman, and Alan is, you can sort of see behind
desperate.
Alan's brain is churning. I don't like it, but I wish I didn't like it.
Not a comment. What I really like about the writing, there's a sort of comment that they've obviously met before and they've had a falling out, so you're seeing the history behind it without it being explained, which I thought is for really, really good writing. One of the things I loved is that, not like Knowing Me, Knowing You, which was very straight, The running gag about who had the oil spill, was it Shell or BP? The programme makers are making that point as well. So we keep getting these tweets about, no, our oil spill, well, there's this one, you're thinking of that one. And I thought actually it just added that extra layer that I definitely wanted it, just, you know, went beyond just a satire of a show. What did anyone think of Susanna Fielding as the foil? Because I think that's a really difficult part to play. As Jenny.
I think it's early days. Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked her in as much as I think she... I hope her character does more. Mm. So, I didn't kind of take it against it, but I hope there's more going on there. She's clearly... She keeps nicking Alan's jokes, doesn't
she? That's what
she?
I really liked. It's obviously, there's that ambition there and they've cracked that.
I thought... what I like about Alan is... Why would a 52-year-old bloke like Alan? Why I like Alan is his flaws are... He can't conceal them. No matter how hard he tries, he can't conceal his flaws. And she has no flaws. She's this kind of dreadnought of televisual ambition with no kink in her armour at all. And this is why Alan is now, finally, he's the underdog in his own show. He's being steamrolled by this brighter, younger, better-looking, more ambitious, unflawed individual. Mm. And I can't say I like her as a character because I think we've all encountered people in life who just seem bulletproof and we don't know why.
Yes.
But I think she's a great thing for the show.
Yeah,
I think she really works.
I can't wait
show.
To see how this dynamic develops. Like, it's a brilliant gif, I think, for episode one.
Yeah.
Is to see, you know, Alan is clearly going to lose it big time.
Yes.
You know, he's really
There's
trying
something
his
awful
best.
Is gonna happen.
Something terrible's going to happen. And she's going to get, you know, her downfall is going to happen. Yeah. Lynn's probably going to be involved. I mean, I think it's really, really promising.
Lynn's taken against her, though. Lynn's got some teeth, hasn't she? And
also, in the credits, we've got the old presenter, John. Is all through the credits, so obviously he's going to come back.
You know
he's
what?
Gonna come
Maybe
back.
I have an inkling.
Or Alan kills him.
I think he's. I have an inkling that he's going to die, and Alan's going to get the gig full time. I think that's how we're going to get a full series out of it.
I'd like Alan to be one of those roving reporters who's sent out and really trying to big up their part. I think that could be.
Well, there was
really
a lot of John Cravening going on in his Sky stuff. It's just endless shots of Alan huffing over the top of a hill in some Millets kind of hiking wear.
Mountain Warehouse, I think he's.
There's two bits that I always love. That Alan, that's sort of coming back in a little bit. I always loved the fact that, do you remember, I think it was in I'm Alan Partridge, where he would go into these reveries where he was a pole dancer. And then they'd develop, and eventually he'd be like wearing, he'd be wearing motorway cones as that kind of Madonna conical bra. Do you think I'm sexy? There's a weird side to Alan, a weird kind of unexplored.
I think that's the bit that turned me into an Alan fan.
The anecdote about his granddad.
Oh,
and
that
his last word being... Granddad.
But we haven't spoken about the best bit, which was his train toilet mime.
I didn't think that was the best bit. I thought that went on for ages.
The best bit was... I enjoyed that so much, just the movement of the hip.
I thought it went on for too long, but surely the best bit was, hello, Alice Clunt.
Classic.
It's Fluck. Yeah.
My one thing is that the trailer that we all saw for weeks and weeks and weeks, I'm really thirsty, can I get some water, wasn't picked up. I wanted him to dry up and not have the water... Because that starts the programme, and I thought it'd be really nice to have that thread in, but that's
pre-deleted scene, additional content.
Yeah. And Alan Partridge, as much as Coogan might wrestle with this love-hate thing with him, he is the gift that keeps on giving, and he's still relevant today, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're all going to keep watching
Badbridge.
Of course.
Yeah.
We're all going to keep watching it. How can we not?
Totally.
Okay, I just crashed the link Partridge style there. It's time for some music chosen by one of our guests, Nadia Shireen. What is your editor's recommendation for the show?
It's Summon the Fire by Comet Is Coming.
And who are they? What are they all about?
Comet Is Coming. They are a jazz outfit. Jazz is the hip new thing. It's been the hip new thing for like 2 years, 3 years. But anyway. 50 years.
52
Shabaka
years.
Hutchins, who's also in...
Star Wars.
Not Star Wars. Oh, my God. Your queen is a reptile. Sons of Kemet.
There you go.
Sons of Kemet, which is one of my favourite albums of last year. And he's this amazing, amazing, amazing musician. And this is just powerful and fiery and sexy, and I love it.
Here we go, then. This is Comet Is Coming with Summon the Fire. Now, Now, sometimes it's a good idea to let someone describe their own album before you start dismantling it. Here's Jason Williamson of Sleaford Mods on their fifth album, Eaten Alive. Eaten Alive speaks for itself, really. Here we are once again in the middle of another elitist plan being digested slowly as we wait to be turned into faeces once more. After the digestive system of the nobles rejects our inedible bones, we exit the arse of rule, we fall into the toilet again and at the mercy of whatever policies are holding order in this shit pipe of this tatty civilization. Fair enough, but can you dance to it? Here's a stool sample. This is OBCT. You know the fakes will always buy. Whenever you go through the line. Fishing, budgings and perch. All draped in sponsorships and hooking self-worth. Sleaford Mods. It's a bit The Fall, a bit Fat Truckers, a bit John Cooper Clarke, a bit Can, and a bit 1977 Human League. Nadia Shireen, did you find much to relate to in this record? Did you enjoy it?
Do you know what? I have always wanted to like Sleaford Mods more than I actually do. So I like them, I like what they say, but I've, you know, struggled to enjoy listening to them. But I think that's changed with this album, because I do think this album has really moved on sonically. You know, I'm a sucker for a melody, and I think I heard loads more in this album, and I'm a simple beast, and so I responded really well to that. I was like, yay, bass lines, tunes.
It's a lot more song-based, as they say. And he's singing, he's doing actual singing.
Actual singing.
On Firewall, I believe. Yeah,
Firewall, which at first I just was like, what? I'm not sure. And then actually I enjoyed it. I mean, I prefer him barking. That, you know, he's really good at barking, but it's interesting to hear. I've never heard it before.
I mean, to the kind of suite of concerns of crap Britain, you know, rubbish jobs and, you know, bad job scenes and you know, awful towns, he's now added the additional layer of guilt at doing well and being well off. I'm in an ass three times the size of my old ass. And that track OBCT is Oliver Bonus Chelsea Tractor.
Oh, is that what it's
about? It's about driving past Oliver Bonus in your Chelsea Tractor and feeling bad about it.
Mm. Well, what I love about it as well is that, you know, a lot is spoken about how, you know, voice of working class Britain, and I'm like, well, okay, actually it's the middle age thing that I love. I love that, you know, he's singing about, you know, going to funerals and that kind of, you know, people getting pissed at funerals and all that kind of thing, and yeah, as you said, putting the bins out, that kind of thing, and those kind of, I don't think he's necessarily got lyrically, I mean, I've only listened to it a couple of times, lyrically it's not as if these lyrics are kind of amazingly insightful and witty, but they're just very stark, and there's kind of beauty in that. They're unflowery and direct and quite and bleak.
It is, you know, it's possible to describe there's a load of middle-aged blokes shouting at each other in the pub, which is fine. I am that middle-aged bloke who shouts in a pub. But it does have, there's a witty aspect to it, which actually you do get from middle-aged blokes shouting in the pub. I mean, the line, Graham Coxon looks like a left-wing Boris Johnson, is really funny.
It is funny. It's called Eaten Alive. They're not that explicit in terms of their targets. I thought it was weird that Graham Coxon is a target as opposed to Jacob Rees-Mogg. Do you know what I mean? It's maybe not quite as... They're not shouting about big ideas necessarily or politics with a big P. It's more about the everyday.
But I always think that, you know, when people go, well, with political music of right now, the political music of, say, the early 80s Specials, Go Town, all the rest of it, took place in a vacuum and nobody was talking about the things they were talking about. Now, you can't move for big P politics literally everywhere. Mm. And to me, they're talking about wider spread of things that don't have to be, what do we think about privatisation?
Yeah.
Hannah, what did you reckon? Did you enjoy it?
Well, to be honest, I've always struggled with Sleaford Mods. Like Nadia, I really want to like them, but they just reminded me of like Stereo MCs for a new millennium. But with this
album, what's wrong with that?
I know, exactly. Hang on a minute, I'm going to launch that. But actually with this album, they said that they'd been listening to Drake and Chaka Khan, so I had a bit of hope there, and I really enjoyed it in the end. I think it did have some good lyrics, and it had that kind of struggle that he's going through at the moment, because he's obviously made it, hasn't he? And he's got two brown bins, as he says on Policy Cream, which, you know, he must be pretty much up there. So how long can you bang on about being working class and having lots of problems if you are driving the Chelsea tractor? And I think that's probably the point that they're at.
But isn't that the kind of, that's actually the more truthful picture of what the country is like? This kind of idea that there's, you know, the kind of, you know, the poor and noble proletariat, you know, living in a Dickensian woodcut, and everybody else is running around drinking champagne, and the country's divided into one group or the other. Mm. This is why I like Half Man, Half Biscuit, because they sing about life in B&Q and, you know, your bus getting cancelled and, you know, as Nadia says, going to people's funerals. The reality of life, particularly for middle-aged white blokes, is much more complicated than it is the working class and is the middle class. People ping-pong across those borders quite a lot, and it's terribly confusing.
I think as well, if you are working class or born working class, you always think of yourself like that, and you always like wonder where the next paycheck comes from. So maybe there's an element of that to it.
But we're a country full of people who tell themselves they're working class when they're not. And, you know, who are often on quite handsome wages, telling themselves, I'm working class because I work. That's the British confusion,
yeah,
isn't
that
it?
Shouldn't be the definition of it. Definitely not.
Well, didn't Jason have a bit of a go at Idols about this?
Yeah.
He sort of accused them of being plastic working class. There's a better phrase for that, I'm sure.
I like that.
Thanks. I think, he said, I discovered that they're actually not working class, and I found that disappointing.
But I find that the most boring subject in the world. The idea that we run around with a bit of litmus paper going, you know, working class, not working class. Yeah. I mean, no other country in the world has this neurosis.
I was quite disappointed when I read that. Because I read that after listening to this album. And I was like, oh.
Sean, what did you reckon to Eaton Alive?
Well, as you know, I love Sleaford Mods and I've loved them. I mean, probably since before they were going. It's been so long.
You're saying you were into them before it was cool. Yeah. You're into the early stuff.
Before they were born, right? I really do. And what I like about them is the honesty of it.
Yeah.
You know, as we're saying in our little class war discussion there, maybe coming from working class roots still means that you go to Waitrose if it's near and, you know, they might have some nice anchovies in a pot. It doesn't stop you from doing that. And that's what he knows. The preoccupations with cake, going to the gym and
his
politics.
Core.
Yes, the core stuff that he talks about a lot. Like, it's his real life. Some of the songs, earlier songs, talk about him walking his kids through the park and stuff. He's not afraid to say, and I think because they made it, in inverted commas, older than, not in their 20s, that he is a middle-aged man, means there's an honesty about, there's a confusion about class, but there is not a confusion about what you believe in. What I really like about this album is it strips away a bit of the lovely phrases in there, like, Airfix dickhead, but there's a vulnerability. He is happy to start singing a little bit. There's a bit of tenderness there. Mm. The beautiful lines, and then you suddenly get, they caught you in the warehouse with a nail gun, and you think, what? So it's one of those things, there's so many layers to it, you need to listen to it. But I find it really warm, and unlike that sort of Crass or Red Wedge or Class War stuff that we were used to in the 80s that came with NME, those tapes, they still haunt me. There is something really real and honest, as I say, about that, and something that's not that masculine, aggressive front.
Yeah,
when you dig through, you know, it's human, man.
It's not Hectoring.
They're not, there's no pretense there, and that's what I really like about
it. It's quite
them.
Self-scourging, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite self-investigative.
And they're happy not to be angry, and they must have the working-class angry man at them all the time, the Arthur Seaton type, that they're meant to be in that box. And Jason is saying, no, I'm not that. I'm also a dad, I'm this, I'm that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't one of them a music therapist or something like
Andrew
that?
Fern, because,
he's got like a proper sort of middle-class arts job.
Yeah.
And there's
the
nothing wrong with
band.
That.
My dad loves them and shows me pictures that he takes of them in Bristol gigs and stuff. My dad is over 70.
Excellent.
But you've hit the nail on the head there, because as I listen to it more, and I do want to listen to it more, because the more I listen to it, the more it grew, I picked up on this very kind of vulnerable masculinity that you just really don't hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a middle-aged vulnerable masculinity. It's basically quite similar to Alan Partridge.
Absolutely.
Oh, to the G.
I would really like to hear Alan and Sleaford Mods.
Oh, what a good idea.
Because it wouldn't be a joke. It would be deathly serious.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. Although I don't think Alan would really understand Sleaford Mods, would he?
No, but he'd try his best,
wouldn't
he?
He'd
gamely have a go.
I think he'd think they were scruffy.
He'd give it a go.
Why aren't you wearing a nice gilet?
But he'd look at the zeitgeist and know I'm having a bit of
that. Yeah. I think that this album is, isn't it top 10 this week or something like that? So this is the most popular they have been, so Alan would have heard of them.
Well, I was going to say, we've got three smash hits alumni here. How would the hits have handled Sleaford Mods?
Cover, posters.
Possibly split cover with Alan.
Oh, yeah.
The Mods meet Alan.
They would have been that interview that I always tried to sneak in that wasn't, we'll have one non-pop band, was that all right? Yeah, but we'd get Bon Jovi or Ash in the olden days. They would be my... my little pleasure.
Because
in the 80s smash hits, when I were a lad,
there would
often be things like Neil from the Young Ones on the front of smash hits.
Yeah.
I've got that one, I think.
All of the Young Ones were on the smash hits at one point, weren't they?
Yeah.
The Young Ones and Cliff.
And there were massive kind of rows internally with Lord Emap at the top of, you know, so you can't put a television comedian on the front of a pop music magazine. They want posters of Jason Donovan or whoever it was at the time in the early 80s. They want posters of Nick Kershaw. Mm. They don't want Neil from the Young Ones. Neil from the Young Ones goes in the front, it sells enormously. Yeah. But that was
he did
was,
have a record out, quite frankly.
And I mean, it was number one record, and yet still Lord Emap was saying you can't put that on the front because it's not a pop magazine.
Really?
Well, the Sleaford Mods say music magazines are shit, don't they, in one of their songs? They say, well, it's the effect.
Talk about kicking someone when they're down. There aren't any left. What is he talking about?
Sleaford Mods.
There are Q and Mojo.
And if Sleaford Mods had been around in the heyday of music magazine, when the Enemy was doing a quarter of a million and Q was doing 300,000, Select was doing 100,000, whatever, they would not only have been a gift, they would have used it for all it was worth. They would never have been out of the magazine. They would have been in reception, as the technical term is.
And it would have been
great value, wouldn't
Like Kim Wilde. Do you see anything between them and the Happy Mondays? Any kind of
yes.
Between them and the Mondays?
And I had a note about Sean Ryder. It's like Sean Ryder cleaned up before he got a record deal. There's something about the redemption, because Jason talks about it on Negative Script, about how he could have screwed up but decided not to. And again, that's going against the template of beleaguered working class man. And there's something along that line of Sean Ryder went that way, Jason went that way in a different political climate and a time, which I think there is a thread there.
Yeah, I think Big Bert was like their Mad Cyril as well. I loved it. I was like,
that's great. That's a great song talking about, like, you know, what's I don't want the plan. What is it talking to God for £25 a month with additional minutes kind of thing?
And they moan about scheduling tweets as well. I really like that. One at 9 and one at 4.
Yeah. We'd never do that, would we, Sean?
You do. Let's cleanse the palate. Another tune from one of our guests, Hannah Verdier. What have you got for us?
Well, if, like me, you're a 40-something woman who only wants to listen to scattergun angry rappers from South London, I have Flohio for you with Bands.
Flohio?
I don't know if that's how you say it. She's not even in my generation.
Who is she and what's this all about then, Hannah?
So she is from South London. She grew up in Bermondsey and she spent her teenage years listening to Lil Wayne. So this one's a bit of an oldie. It's from last year.
Okay.
But she's just becoming the one to watch, I think, now. And I think she's going to do some good things.
And is this about bands or elastic bands or another sort of band?
You decide.
Okay. Okay, Flohio with Bands. Still trying to work this flow. Stop that, man. You can never dig this gold. Feel this cold. Land of flows, get evicted quick. Now you're doing road. Chat about me. Yes, I turn it round. Love my song. You can't turn this down. Grateful tower couldn't burn me out. And I send mad love to who's mourning now. Mourning now. Your nigga yawning. Like, where's the money? Wanna cut 100 bands. They want me in your section now. This attention must have got you real mad. Who put you in charge? Them low bars you got there. Couldn't get signal. Been on this since day dot. Don't fear no. Laugh louder. You crusty clowns. Get ruthless. What are you looking clueless for? Finally, you can't see everything, and I for one managed to miss Get Out, the acclaimed social commentary horror movie from 2017, written and directed by Jordan Peele, who later produced Black Klansman. But it's just gone up on Netflix, which is as good an excuse as any to revisit a movie that's either a Stephen King take on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, or maybe it's George A. Romero's The Colour Purple. Black guy visits white girlfriend's parents, the hills are alive with Caucasian cringe, and then it gets really crazy, like this.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bruh.
Meeting families. Taking road trips, don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
You ready for this?
I'm back and be.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here. Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out!
Yo! Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. If there's too many white people, I get nervous.
Get Out was acclaimed as the most original and timely horror film in years, because what's more terrifying than a black guy stuck in the white suburbs? Sean, you're a huge fan and were lobbying to get for us to do
I
this.
I was.
Why certainly. Are you a huge fan? Set it up for us.
I saw this at the cinema, didn't know quite what to expect and just came out thinking, actually, I thought, fuck yes, well, we can swear because we're in a podcast. Daniel Kaluuya plays Chris, who is a black photographer in New York, we believe. I don't think it's quite explicit, but he lives in the city. He goes to the country as he visits his new white girlfriend's parents. Lots of signposting at the beginning where she talks about, it's okay, don't worry, they're not racist. There's a lot of they're not racist. And so we're given a nice, sort of comfy introduction to what's going to be a lovely family weekend, and then the horror comes in, and the horror tropes and the nightmare, and Chris's own personal journey begins.
It's a hell of a journey. Nadia, you're our non-white person on the panel today.
Hi.
Hooray! what did she reckon? Are you a horror aficionado?
So I used to really, really watch loads of horror films, you know, loads of classic British horror, and then I had a child and now I can't watch, you know, even a very tense episode of Binge or something. I have to switch off. So with it, I was a little bit nervous, and there was a point where I was like, I don't know if I can do this. Quite early on, but I'm so glad I persevered, and I absolutely loved it. The tension, so I'm really interested to know, I'm not a black man, but I'm a brown woman, and I'm a brown woman who grew up in a very white area, and I started to feel physically sick and kind of queasy, and at the same time so sort of delighted to see this on screen. When Daniel Kaluuya, his character Chris, is at, as you've said, a party full of well-heeled white people, and they are liberal. They're, you know, it's not like they're kind of hicks being openly racist. They're like, oh, aren't you wonderful? Can I feel your arm? Look at your, oh, goodness. So they are trying to be woke. It's a post-Obama film. And I found that astonishingly, it really resonated with, you know, me growing up and people going, isn't your hair marvellous? Can I touch your hair? Do you know, have you read A Suitable Boy? It's marvellous. I wish I was joking. So, but to see that, it really resonated. And it was, you know, so satisfying, and it just goes to crazy places, and I don't want to ruin it for anyone. But
to an extent, the kind of white person cringe thing is the horror.
It's that was the horror.
It's a good two-thirds of the film, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was watching this thinking, I can imagine that seeing this in a cinema with a very mixed audience rather than me in my front room with my cat, who was a black cat, by the way, so it's very well, would have been very, very different, because I can imagine myself sort of cringing inside out while perhaps black members of the audience are going, yes. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. I mean, even at that level, before we get into the full Tobe Hooper carry-on.
I was already gone.
It's a brilliant, brilliant thing. But the additional thing I really loved about it is the fact that the kind of white people trying so hard and going on about how great Obama was, really great, wasn't he? I really loved Obama. And the way the dad keeps saying, thang, as well. Thang. Is not tacked onto the horror script. It is intrinsically connected to the horror MacGuffin that makes the whole story flip. It's about that.
Absolutely. It's people saying, do you play golf? Love Tiger Woods.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's people saying, you know, and I can't say it's that explicit, but it's someone going, did you see Nadia win Bake Off? It is similar. I'm not such
like, well done, you guys.
Yeah, the same name.
Like high five. Yeah, do you think
it
might be? Yeah, it might be that. Yeah. But yeah, it was astonishing. I haven't seen that very tricky kind of grey area of racism or you know, kind of awkward race interaction conveyed so well on screen. Certainly not in a film that's had such huge distribution. And
without
so
wanting to get too much into spoilers, and how much can you spoil a movie that's 2 years old anyway? But without it is, and also without wanting to be too much, you know, too New York Times opinion page thing, it's very much about white culture consuming black culture and black people. Without wanting to get too much into spoilers, which I thought was the brilliant, brilliant, clever thing about it.
It was brilliant, and I wish we could talk about the ending, because
there is a final shot.
We won't.
I think I can describe the final shot without ruining it a little bit.
Really?
The final shot of one particular character is the most horrible kind of, like, white person nearly gets the victory they wanted all along.
But
and if you've seen the film, you know exactly why. And it's just brilliantly put together. Hannah, we haven't talked to you about this. Now, let's be honest, you didn't actually see to the very, very end, did you?
No, I'm halfway through.
Okay.
But the way it was billed as like an innovative horror film, I actually thought that all the racism, that was the horror, because it's so, so relentless going all the way through, all the like casual, like you say, trying to be liberal. And I thought, oh, maybe they've twisted that and that is a new form of horror in my mind, but haven't got to the really terrifying bit yet. But yeah. I think it was brilliantly done. I think it's a very beautiful film as well. And what I love about it is that, I mean, I don't watch a lot of horror, but I love the where it seems like normal life and then just starts going wrong. I love that journey of that.
What a name that you don't drop anymore, Polanski. But it reminds me of Polanski, who is, for whatever he did in his private life, is an amazing director. And to capture that paranoia, and whether it's a black man's paranoia, it's a white woman's, whoever we're going to choose, to capture that as if people are not talking about you behind your back, but certainly thinking other things that they're not saying overtly. And to have that creeping in and to say, that's the horror for you, is... it's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think that's what it does so, so well. Yeah. And it does it as soon as they get to the countryside. The wonderful idea that the city is sane and the country is mad. And
oh, I love that films as well. Like I love that.
The sidekick, Rob.
Yes.
Oh, no, it's Rod, isn't it?
Rod, the TSA guy, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
I told you not to go to the country.
I told you not to do it. I told you not to go out with a white woman. You know, he may be right. I thought also the way that they can play that horror and then the comedy of him. Yes. But also he is the truth finder. He is us trying to navigate what's happening through the film. I thought really, really cleverly done.
And also this is why it's Black The Shining.
That's
it's
what I was just going to say.
I've horror-slained you.
Just going to say it.
It is, isn't it? It absolutely is.
Hey, white man, let me say my piece.
Okay. Say your piece.
No, but I was just going to pick up on what you were saying, Sean, that yes, that reminded me so much of The Shining, where you're throwing back to, what's his name, the guy in The Shining, you know, the janitor guy. Mm. But there are loads of other echoes of The Shining. Like, at the beginning, Chris has been shown around this palatial country estate, and that's like The Shining, when the family turn up at the Overlook and they're being...
The deer. Is a spoiler. They hit a deer in a car, and the metaphor in horror that, you know, and the signifiers and the symbols that we see before action happens, things like that is absolutely spot on.
Also, all horror movies have to be about the horror genre now, don't they? They're all meta. They're all about, they're not just a horror movie, they're about what horror movies are. And this is about what horror movies are, because it uses the horror genre and all the beats. Oh, here's the guy that you might be going to help you. Oh, turns out they aren't. Mm. Oh, here's it. Don't go into that room. Don't do that thing. All of those kind of like the kind of chassis and the armature of horror is there. But it all connects to like the horror is the idea of black people turning into white people's idea of what a black person ought to be. Mm. And you see these lobotomized, you know, smiling black domestic staff. Oh, well, we just couldn't bear to let them go because they're such great. Well, they're like part of the family, really.
And when you watch it again, you see all the clues. Yeah. So having watched this the second time then, from the cinema to there, it's so beautifully made. You see them lay it down like a carpet in front of him. It's bleedingly obvious.
I found that hugely upsetting, actually. Yeah. I found it really upsetting seeing I can't talk about it without spoiling it too much, but there are some black people there who are behaving in a kind of neutered way.
Well, again, to put my New York Times op-ed page on, there's an awful lot of internalising whiteness going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. So, I thought it was absolutely incredible, and I wish I'd watched it years ago.
Yeah, it's a great film, and I'm glad the Flicks are putting it out because it was nominated for lots of Oscars.
Yeah.
So it has had its plaudits. I don't think it got as many as it should have done. However, I've met lots of people who hadn't seen it, so hopefully more people will get to see it because it's a great film.
One little thing as well on the non-woke tip. Setting aside the social content, social commentary, this is a horror film which does not stint on the gore either.
No.
When it's time to start delivering the gore, nobody's holding back.
Good noises, good sound effects as well.
Very crunchy.
Holy work.
Absolutely. Right then, we're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter is heaving or hoving into view. What will our guests be discussing over an off-brand British lager in a Nottinghamshire Wetherspoons with Sleaford Mods? Nadia, I believe you're struggling with embarrassing bands that you used to love and the legacy of groups.
Oh, God, yeah. I've just had to confront... you know, I'm not a big believer in guilty pleasures. I'm pretty out and proud about everything that I love musically, apart from a period of time when I wasn't just a bit into Queen. I was, like, really obsessed with Queen. And I'm struggling with it now because because they're arses, aren't they? And so that, like, you know, with Bohemian Rhapsody coming back, with the Oscars and all the rest of it, I've had to confront it. My friend, who I was in love with Queen with, she refuses to watch it. I'm like begging her. I'm saying, please, in a safe place, let's just watch the author film, because we have to. Because we were, you know, we were like 12 and we were in the Queen fan club and we went to a Brian May solo concert and I had Roger Taylor's solo albums. All that happened. That all happened, okay?
Who even are you?
I don't know. It just was a thing. But I haven't... But what I wanted to know is any... You know, there are times when I'm just like, I can't believe I was so in love with that band. They're awful. And then other times I'm less harsh on myself and I'm like, ah, that's... You know, we're all allowed to say Sheer Heart Attack's a great album, isn't it? But I really loved them. And
I think Queen are a special... I mean, just as separately to this, I think Queen are a special case because they were so ridiculously diverse that you can say simultaneously they were dreadful and they were brilliant, and it's both true. Because if you're a Hot Space Queen, if you're Another One Bites the Dust Queen, I've even got a soft spot for Seven Speeds of Rye. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of amazing Queen and there's a lot of absolutely unspeakable Queen. And fundamental to me, because I actually went to see Bohemian Rhapsody the other day, would never go and see it, you know, by choice, but it was a thing on the go, I'll go and see it. And you kind of get it becomes very clear that Queen's kind of superpower is they were the, for all of the, however you want to describe the invention, the most crassly commercially minded band ever. They, you know, Freddie in particular could just zero in on something that was going to be huge, and Brian May as well. They would just do it without a single thought of what are people going to think about this? Mm-hmm. Are people going to like it? No, we're not going to bother about critics. We're going to go straight to the most basically minded person. I think Mojo once described Queen as rock music for 12-year-olds, as if it was an insult. And I'm not sure that's really an insult.
Well,
because
it worked for me when I was 12. You know?
I think there's so much snobbery around that film. I enjoyed that film, and I really enjoy critically panned films. And they are...
This is a critically panned film that won Oscars.
Yeah, I know, but everyone's like, oh, yeah, but it's really terrible. But I just happened to go and see it. Like, yeah, you did. I thought he was brilliant in it, and I thought the story was really good. And you know that thing about them jumping on a bandwagon, maybe, when I think it was John Deacon is credited with, I've listened to this disco, and then they did Another One Bites the Dust, and he brings out the bass line. It's like, yes, I love it. Well, I mean, loved Freddie as well, and I just thought, that's great.
There's no bad way to make a great record. But going back to your point of, like, things that you're guilty about when you were... that you loved when you were a kid that you feel guilty about.
Well, yeah, and I don't have many, but that is one of the... I don't feel guilty, but I just struggle with it. I'm like, God, we were so upset. I used to write... You know, we used to write stories
I
where we go on holiday with...
I think you should get some merch. I think you should wear the T-shirts. I think you should do a thing. I mean, maybe psychologically. Because if you revision your own history...
Yeah.
That's bad for your brain, man.
Oh, well, I was looking at the stuff that I hammer...
Yeah.
And it is basically everything from when I was 12 years old. Still, it's the Specials, it's pop music by M, the greatest record ever made by anybody under any circumstances. You know, all the music, you know, I was 12 in...
Da, though, by Trio, please.
No, come on. I was 12 in 1979, and it still is the most amazing, incredible year. Sparks' Number One in Heaven, 1978, is out again in a deluxe edition this week. A perfect record, absolutely perfect. Mega disco, ideas, craziness. And basically, I still like everything I liked when I was 12. Like the modern versions of it.
Yeah, me too, mostly. Yeah. Just Queen of my aberration.
I was sitting in the front room listening to Sparks' Number One in Heaven, reading the new Fantastic Four. How have I moved on in 40 years? I absolutely haven't.
You're not going to.
Not going to. Sean, have you got things that you're guilty about like this? Are you going to stick owning everything?
I'm just going to revise my history, actually, after my advice to Nadia. And I just like cool stuff.
Fair enough. Hannah, your closing time chatter.
Well, I am really, really excited that Motley Crue's The Dirt, the book by Neil Strauss, which I adore, is coming to Netflix.
How can they
in March.
Do that?
I know.
It's rude.
I know. And there's on the trailer, Tommy Lee's wearing his leopard skin trousers, his sister's, I think. And Douglas Booth is going to be Nikki Six. And I'm just loving all the... Because I love a straightforward rockumentary, but I'm loving all these films that are starting to come out. And also, there's a Celine Dion biopic coming.
Live and Let Die on. How can you make a biopic of Celine Dion? Nothing's happened.
That's what you think.
Loads has happened.
I've delved into her psyche a bit more recently. She's a funny woman, I think. I think it's going to be good.
You'll eat your words.
With the sound down, obviously, because you can't listen to her singing. But The Dirt, I'm so excited.
Is The Dirt going to be... So it's not a documentary based on the book.
People playing them.
Amazing.
Alan Partridge, he could, you know, Steve Coogan.
I'll never forget my favourite bit in The Dirt. Isn't there a bit where the bassist, they leave him for dead in the sea? Like, they just said he's drowned. And then the chapter ended, they just left me there. I woke up, you know, face down in the sand.
I really wish they'd make the Marilyn Manson one, though.
I've not.
Because that is, it's incredible. It's really, really good. It explains a little more about him, but that would make such
a good
film.
Was he actually Brian from The Wonder Years?
He addresses that in the biography, and
does
no, he
wasn't.
Aww. And neither did he have a rib removed. There
good
you go.
God. I presume you're terribly excited about Brad Pitt's forthcoming Chris Cornell movie, then, are you?
Oh, hang on, I hadn't heard about this.
Yeah, Brad Pitt's going to play Chris Cornell in the most boring group of in history.
Oh, so. Can't imagine what happens.
Spoiler, he dies at the end, I think. Sian, what's your closing time chatter?
The Oscars had no hosts this year, as everybody is aware, but it was watched by 11% more people, which is actually 3 million more people watched it and had no host at all. Beware us.
She's having a host-free podcast.
Yeah. Jack Whitehall, if anyone saw. I'm riffing now. Brits. Ooh, who's paying you lots of money?
Oh, I didn't see. Was it bad?
I think the idea of a host, it's so old-fashioned. It's so corny, and it's usually a horrible white bloke being corny and lechy at women.
Very scripty as well. I think you can tell Jack Whitehall didn't write that.
He didn't.
And I love him. I really do.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a... That's a guilty pleasure, isn't it?
And so I've seen this as quite a young, fresh sort of idea. Let's have no hosts. Let's have no voiceovers. Let's just let people be. Yeah, I think it's really good. Anyway, as I say, that's
just
a job,
party.
Though.
Well, it is, yeah. I didn't even know the Brits were on, to be honest. They just seemed to go past by without making any impression
whatsoever.
They weren't
good. Put it that way. Mm. Yeah, they had you. What's that woman? Jess Glynn taking off her makeup, and that
she's
was meant to be like a massive thing. Then they had the 1975 on a sort of like a Jamiroquai thing. I thought, okay,
we're
things
old,
change.
Guys. We're old. We are. It's not for us.
You know what? They need to regenerate it. Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood get them back.
Annie Lennox.
Amazing.
I had that on tape. We used to watch it regularly.
Yeah.
And now the Four Tops. And then Boy George comes out. And he does, I'm the one top. And gaily carries on.
Oh, yeah. Things we didn't know then that we know now. The one top. Interesting. Anyway, my closing time chatter is the East German Secret Police's illustrated guide for identifying youth subcultures, punks, goths, teds and more.
Is this real?
It is real. It was discovered by a website whose name escapes me. I think it's called Open Cultures. I'll put it on the Facebook page. It was a guide to Stasi operatives to identify young people's youth culture crowds and their political alignment so you can keep a lid on the kids. This is in 1985. Yeah. There was only 3 more years of the DDR to go, and then it was all going to be, you know, farewell. But they identified the following subgroups: Teds, Trampers, who were apparently trogs, Grufties, which were the goths, Grufties, and Poppers, who were interested in Poppers o'clock. And someone has translated all this stuff. It can say Heavies, i.e. trogs, once held a deprecative attitude towards the state and society, but seemed to be becoming increasingly society-conforming. Goths were a satanic and death cult.
Fair enough.
They're just called the cult now, German secret police. And are noted for their glorification of creepy effects. And apparently punks are often regulars in public church youth groups. So this is the Stasi's take on this.
Then,
it is, yeah. And grufties and poppers are completely uninterested in politics.
Yay, I want to be a grufty.
I am a grufty and a popper. So this was how the Stasi were going to control the kids. This is how we won the Cold War.
By having a booklet.
By having a booklet. And it's really quite badly drawn booklet. Bad drawings of grufties and poppers.
That's my next book.
The
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This would make a good BuzzFeed quiz.
Are you a grufty? are you a tramper? Yeah. I think as life goes by and as I've got more sleep at Monty, I become more and more of a tramper. So yeah, I'll stick it on the Facebook.
Do that. We'll stick it on Instagram.
Get on the gram. And that's the show. Thanks to Hannah Verdier and Nadia Shireen for coming in. Patreon backers, look out for the extra bit, which is arriving soon. We're going to be suggesting a few more TV reboots after the return of Alan Partridge. There was some sad news this week with the death of Mark Hollis of Talk Talk, and we're going to play out with a bit of Talk Talk in a minute. Nadia, you were quite a fan, weren't you, of Talk Talk?
Yeah, I was a big fan, actually. You know, it's taken me back a little bit how many other people were fans, because I think they were a very insular band. The music was very melancholic and introspective, and they're certainly a band I wouldn't stick on at a party. You know, they were very much my having a long walk and putting my headphones on band. So I was really sad. He was very much someone who lived his life on his own terms. You know, he ducked out of music about 20 years ago, I think, just to be a dad. And I think he'd said all he had to say. But lots of people are rightly saying how brilliant Spirit of Eden and Laughingstock are, the two last Talk Talk albums, and his solo album. I'm a big fan of The Colour of Spring, which is slightly poppier, maybe a bit more accessible for any listener who hasn't heard Talk Talk yet, I highly recommend it.
Well, we're going to play out with an excerpt from the penultimate track from the final Talk Talk album, Laughingstock, from 1991. It's called Newgrass. Nadia, thanks for coming in. Hannah Verdier. Nadia and Verdier, thank you for coming in. And we're going to do the extra bit in a minute, so listen up, Patreon backers. Thanks to Hannah, Nadia, co-pilot Sean and producer Sophie Black. We'll see you all next week. Here's Talk Talk with a bit of Newgrass from Laughingstock.